Hachette Audio presents The Last Mile, written by David Baldacci, read by Keith Brewer and Orla Cassidy. To the memories of Allison Parker and Adam Ward, two brilliant lights taken from us far too soon. And to Vicky Gardner, whose courage and grace are inspiring testaments to the resiliency of the human spirit. Chapter 1. Mars, Melvin. In here, anywhere, anytime, they called out your name backwards, and he would instantly respond when he heard his. Even on the toilet. Like being in the military, only he'd never joined. He'd been brought here very much against his will. Mars, Melvin? Yes, sir. Here, sir. Taking a crap, sir. Because where else would I be except here, sir? He didn't know why they did it this way, and had never bothered to ask. The answer would not have mattered to him in the least, and it might have led to a guard baton slamming against the side of his head. He had other things to concern him here at the Texas State Penitentiary at Huntsville. It was called the Walls Unit because of the prison's red brick walls. Opened in 1849, it was the oldest prison in the Lone Star State, and it also housed the execution chamber. Mars was officially prisoner 747, like the plane. The guards at the death row prison from which he'd been brought called him Jumbo because of it. And while he wasn't huge, he wasn't small either. Most folks would look up to him, if only because they had to. 6'2", plus 3/4 inch tacked on for good measure. He knew his exact height only because they'd measured him precisely at the NFL Combine. They'd measured everything about him at the Combine. While going through the process, his mind had drawn parallels to slaves on the market square as potential owners methodically poked and prodded the merchandise. Well, unlike his slave ancestors, at least he would have had lots of money to deal with the wreckage of his body after his playing days were over. He was also still 230 pounds. No fat, just rock. No mean feat with the crap they served for food in here. Processed in huge factories, loaded with fat and sodium, as well as chemicals they probably used to make everything from concrete to carpets. Killing me softly with your crappy food. He'd been in this place almost as long as he'd not been in this place. And the time had not gone by fast. It didn't feel like 20 years. It felt like 200. But it didn't matter anymore. It would be over soon. This was the day. His final, final appeal. Denied. He was dead. He had been brought to the Huntsville prison from the Polunsky unit's death row in Livingston, Texas, 60 miles to the east, in anticipation that this time the state would get its man after a 2-decades-long wait. His lawyer's pale face had held a bleak expression when she'd conveyed this news to him, but she would wake up the next day. Not me. Soon he would be listening for the tap-tap of heels heading his way. The puffing of the burly guards holding the shiny shackles. The solemn warden who would forget his name the next day. The pious man of God clutching his Bible and reading aloud his verses because you were supposed to have something spiritual to cling to on your way out of here. Not out of prison, out of life. Texas executed more inmates than any other state. Over 500 in just the last 30 years. For nearly a century, starting in 1819, they did it by hanging. Then they used the electric chair, called Old Sparky, and 361 inmates had been put to death by electrocution over 4 decades. Now, Texas used lethal injection to send you off to the hereafter. Either way, you were still dead. By law, executions could not begin before 6 p.m., Mars had been told they would come for him at midnight. Well, nothing like dragging this out, he thought. Made for a really long and really shitty day. Walking dead man, he'd been called. Good riddance, he'd heard more times than he could count from the guards. He didn't want to look back. Not to the epicenter of this whole thing. But really, how could he not? So as the final moment neared, he started to think of them. The murders of Roy and Lucinda Mars, his white father and black mother. Back then, that combination had been weird, different, exotic even, certainly in West Texas. Now it was commonplace. Every kid coming in now looked like bits and pieces of 50 different types of humanity. One recently incarcerated punk was the product of biracial parents, who in turn were also the children of non-traditional pairings. So the new kid, an idiot who'd blown away a store clerk over a shoplifted bag of Twizzlers, was a mishmash of black, brown, and white, with a dash of Chinese thrown in. And he was also a Muslim, though Mars had never seen the man get on his knees and pray five times a day, as some did in here. His name was Anwar. He was originally from Colorado, and he had started telling people he really wanted to become Alexis. Mars sat up on the bunk in his cell and looked at his watch. It was time to do his thing. The last time he would ever do this, in fact. His jumpsuit was white, and on the back were the letters D and R, printed in black. They stood for death row. Mars had equated it to a snake's rattle, warning folks to stay the hell away. He dropped to the coolness of the concrete floor and did 200 push-ups, first on fists, then on fingertips, and finally from the downward dog position, lightly touching the crown of his bald head on the concrete with each pass. Next, he performed 300 deep squats in sets of six, exploding up with every rep. Depth charges, he called them. Then followed yoga and Pilates for strength, balance, range of motion, and most important, flexibility. He could touch his toes to his forehead with his legs ramrod straight. No small feat for a big, ropey-muscled man. Then came the 1,000 stomach and core reps that seared his abs like acid. It was the reason he had rock-hard obliques and an 8-pack. His belly button stretched so tight it looked more like a mole than where his umbilical cord had once attached. Next came flat-out plyomania, where he pushed off all four walls and the floor in a series of maneuvers, many of his own devising. He was like Spider-Man or Fred Astaire dancing on ceilings. He had a lot of hours to plan such things in prison. His life was very structured, but it also offered up a load of free time. Most inmates just sat around doing nothing. There were no classes, no rehabilitation of any kind. The unofficial prison motto was straightforward: rehab is for pussies. Finally, Mars ran in place for so long that he lost track of time, high-kneeing it the whole way. It was crazy that he was doing this today of all days. But he had done it pretty much every day since he'd been in here, and part of him felt this was his last act of defiance. They would not rob him of it. At least he didn't have to refuse the traditional final meal, because Texas no longer offered one. He didn't want their crap inside him at the end. He preferred to die on an empty stomach. No one had visited him, because he had no one who wanted to visit him. He was alone, as he had been the last 20 years. He wondered what the papers would say the next day. It would be a small story, probably. There was nothing new about another black man getting the Lone Star State's lethal spa treatment. Hell, it was hardly worth a photo. But they would recount the crimes of which he'd been convicted. Surely they would. And that would be the only memory of him for many. Melvin Mars, the murderer. He cooled down, the sweat pooling off him and staining the concrete that was already badly scarred with far worse things than perspiration. Condemned men had been known to defecate on the floor before they walked to their deaths. As his breathing normalized, he sat on his bunk and tipped his head back against the wall. In his old cell, he had named the walls Reed, Sue, Johnny, and Ben after the superhero fighting team, the Fantastic Four. It was just something to do in a place where he had nothing to do. Each day filled with whatever he could think of to fill it. Mars often fantasized about sexy Sue Storm, but he more closely related to Ben Grimm, the thing, the freak. As an athlete, Mars had been a freak, in a good way. Yet he could be thoughtful, like the brainy Reed. He also related to the flame ball Johnny Storm, Sue's kid brother, because he felt like he was on fire every second of every day. Principally because every day was like every other day in here. A living hell, actually, hence the flames. This was day 7,342 for him. The last day for him. He looked at his watch again. 5 ticks till doomsday. He had spent a year in solitary shortly after going to prison. The reason was simple. His life was over, his dreams shattered, his hard work for naught, and he was pissed beyond all reckoning. His punishment for beating the crap out of three prisoners and then taking on a half dozen guards, and more than holding his own until they tased and nearly clubbed him to death? 24 hours in a 60-square-foot cell with a slit for a window for a year. No words spoken to him. Never saw another face. Never felt the touch of someone else's skin. The food was shoved through the door slot along with toilet paper and occasionally washcloths and soap, and even less occasionally clean prison garb. He showered in a corner where the water was either ice or scalding. He slept on the floor and mumbled, screamed, cursed, and finally sobbed. That's when he'd realized that human beings, for better or worse, were undeniably social creatures. Without interaction, they went mad. And Mars had nearly gone mad inside that cell. It had been day 169. He remembered it clearly, had even scratched the numbers out on the wall with bloody fingernails. His mind had nearly gone. There was but one shred left. And he had used that shred like a life vest in a tsunami, his port in the storm. He had focused on an imaginary old girlfriend, Tatiana. In his mind, she was married now, with six kids, big-hipped and bloated, surly and unhappy, and so missing him. But back then, this imagined person had been perfect. Her face, her body, her limitless love for him allowed him to survive day 169, and then make it through 196 more. When the door opened, the first face he saw was Tatiana's, superimposed over the body of a 300-pound racist nightmare of a young guard, named aptly Big Dick, who told Mars to get his mulatto butt up or else he'd be eating through a straw for the rest of his life. And when it was over, Melvin Mars was a changed man. He had never done anything that would ever put him back in there. If he did, he knew that he would have killed himself. He wouldn't have waited for the death chamber. Death chamber. It was right down the hall. The last mile, they called it. Yet it wasn't a mile. It was actually only 30 feet, which was good because most guys collapsed before they got there. But they had big guards who picked you up and carried you the rest of the way. Texas killed you dead, whether you took it brave or not. The Supreme Court had debated the cruel and unusual aspects of death by lethal injection because of quite a few instances where the inmate had been in terrible agony before he died. The court had come down on the side of letting it continue. Appalling agony be damned. It wasn't like the condemned's victims hadn't suffered horrific pain and fear. So who could say they were wrong? Mars couldn't. He just hoped they got it right with him. The death chamber was not large, 9 by 12 feet, with cheery turquoise-painted brick walls and metal door, which seemed out of place with the room's purpose. You were being executed, not vacationing in the Caribbean. The gurney, which came with a comfy pillow and sturdy leather straps, was set near the center of the room. There were two adjacent rooms with glass windows looking into the chamber. One was for families of the victim. The other was for family of the person being executed. Mars knew that in his case, the groups were one and the same. And he also knew that both rooms would be empty. He sat back on his bunk, soaking in the stink of his own sweat, his mind drifting back to the only good memories he had left. He was hardly a jumbo in the world of college football, but he'd been big for a running back. Most important, he'd been long on talent. The NFL was considered a lock for someone like him. He had been a Heisman Trophy finalist his senior year, the only tailback in the group. The others had all been quarterbacks. He could run over, around, or simply through anyone. He could block, and his soft hands could catch the ball coming out of the backfield. And he nearly always made the first guy miss with an instinctive lateral move. A rare talent the NFL gurus lapped up. And when he needed the turbos, they flared to life, and he was gone. The only thing left to do was hand the ball to the ref after scoring and go let coach pat his butt on the sidelines. His official time in the 40-yard dash at the combine was 4.31 seconds. 20 years ago, that was serious speed, even for a corner or a receiver, much less a monster running back with shoulders as wide as the sky who made his living smashing between the tackles. And it would still be considered exceptional wheels even today. God-given it was. He was the total package, a freak of nature, they called him. He felt a smile spread across his sweaty face. Yes, a lock. A lock with a big paycheck. This was long before the salary constraints for rookies had been implemented. He could have scored big bucks from day one, millions and millions of them, a mansion, cars, women, respect. He was a guaranteed first rounder, everyone said. Probably top five. He would probably go ahead of several of the quarterbacks he had competed against for the Heisman. It was rumored that the New York Giants, coming off a couple crappy years, and the Tampa Bay Bucks, coming off many crappy years, and both armed with a high draft pick, would love to take him and open the bank of their wealthy owners in doing so. Hell, he might even hoist some Super Bowl hardware one day. It was all looking good. He'd worked his ass off for all of it. No one had given him anything. The hurdles had been immense. He had leapt them all. And then the jury had spoken. We find the defendant guilty. And no one in the world of professional football gave a damn about 4.31 Mars Melvin anymore. Jumbo had crashed. There were no survivors. And in a few minutes, there would be no more of him. He would be laid to rest in a potter's field because he had no one left to bury him proper. He would have been 42 years old in 2 months. His 41st had been his very last birthday, as it turned out. He looked at his watch again. The time was up. His watch told him that, and so did the sound of the footsteps coming down the hall. He had long since made up his mind. He would die like a man, back straight, head high. Suddenly he felt a lump in his throat and his eyes moistened. He tried to breathe normally, trying to keep it all together. This was it. He looked around his cell and saw the walls of his death row cage back at the Polunsky unit. See you, Sue, you fine woman. Adios, Johnny. Godspeed, Ben. Take care, Reed. He stood and put his back against the wall, maybe to stiffen his spine. Like going to sleep, man. You just ain't waking up is all. Like going to sleep. The door to his cell opened, and the men were revealed standing there. 3 suits and 4 uniforms. The suits looked terrified. The uniforms ticked off. Mars noted this, and also that there was no man up the cloth holding his Bible. Something was definitely off. The man with slender glasses and a build to match stepped gingerly into the cell, as though he expected the door to close, trapping him inside forever. Mars could seriously relate to the feeling. The other suit's expressions were now wary, like they knew there was a bomb in here somewhere, but they had no idea when it might go off. Skinny glasses cleared his throat. He looked at the floor, the wall, the ceiling, the one light high up on the ceiling, everywhere, except at Mars. It was as though the big, sweaty, biracial dude 5 feet from him was invisible. He cleared his throat again. To Mars, it sounded like all the muck jostling around in the world's largest sewer. Staring at the floor now, Skinny Glasses said, "There's been an unexpected development in your case. Your execution has been called off." Mars Melvin didn't say anything back. Chapter 2. He was still dressed in his white jumpsuit with the warning on the back, but something else was missing. He had been taken from his cell to this room without having to don the chains, a first since his time in prison. Although a half dozen guards lined the wall just in case he became unruly. 4 men sat across from him. He didn't know any of them. They were all white, all dressed in baggy suits. The youngest was about his age. They looked like they would rather be any place else on Earth. They stared across at Mars, and he just as resolutely stared back at them. He wasn't going to say anything. They had brought him to the party. They were going to have to start the music. The man in the center of the table rustled some papers set in front of him. I'm sure you're wondering what's going on, Mr. Mars. Mars inclined his head slightly, but still didn't say anything. He hadn't heard a white guy call him Mr. since, hell, he couldn't remember a white guy ever calling him that. At the NFL Combine, they'd just called him Holy Shit. In prison, they called him whatever they wanted to. The man continued, "The fact is that someone else has confessed to committing the murders that you were convicted of." Mars blinked a few times and sat up straighter. He put his huge hands that had made soft targets for many a quarterback on the table. "Who?" His voice felt strangely unfamiliar, as though someone else was speaking on his behalf. The man glanced down the table at one of his colleagues, who was older and looked more in control than the rest. This man nodded at the younger gent. The first man said, "His name is Charles Montgomery." "Where is he?" "In a state prison in Alabama. He's actually also awaiting execution for unrelated crimes." "Do you believe he did it?" asked Mars. "We're investigating." "What does he know?" asked Mars. "About the murders." The man again looked at the older man. This time the fellow seemed indecisive. Mars sensed this and swiveled his gaze to him. "Why else would you have stopped my execution? Because some con in Bama said he did it? I don't think so. He had to know something that only the real killer would have." The older man nodded and seemed to view Mars in a new and more favorable light. He said, "He did. Certain things that only the murderer would have known. You're exactly right on that point." "Okay, that makes sense," said Mars, taking a deep breath. Despite his words, he couldn't seem to process what they were telling him. "Do you know Mr. Montgomery?" asked the first man. Mars turned his attention back to him. "Never heard of him till you said his name. Why?" "Just trying to verify certain facts." Mars nodded again. He knew exactly what fact the guy was getting at. Had Mars hired Montgomery to kill his parents? "I don't know him," he said flatly. He looked around the room. "So now what?" "You will remain in prison until certain things can be verified." "And what if you can't verify them?" The older man said, "You have been duly convicted of murder, Mr. Mars. That conviction was upheld over many appeals over many years. You were scheduled to be executed tonight. All that cannot be overturned in a few hours. The process has to be given a chance to work." "So how long before the process works its magic?" The man shook his head. "I can't give you a reliable timetable now. I wish I could, but it would be impossible. I can tell you that we have folks on the way to Alabama to interview Mr. Montgomery more thoroughly. And on this end, the Texas authorities have reopened the investigation. We are doing all we can to see that justice is done, I can assure you." "Well, if he said he killed my parents and I'm still in prison waiting to die, I'd say that justice isn't being done." "You have to be patient, Mr. Mars." "Well, I've been patient for 20 years. "Then a bit more time will not inconvenience you any. Does my attorney know?" "She has been informed and is on her way here as we speak." "She should be part of this investigation." "And she will be. We want full and complete transparency here, nothing less. Again, our goal is the truth." "I'm nearly 42. What about all these years of my life gone? Who's going to pay for that?" The man's face turned to granite, and his tone became more officious. "We need to deal with one thing at a time in a professional manner. That is how it has to be." Mars looked away, blinking rapidly. He doubted that if these guys were in his shoes, they would be so calm and professional about it. They'd be screaming bloody murder, threatening to sue everyone even remotely involved in all this. But he was just supposed to deal with one thing at a time. Be patient. It shouldn't be an inconvenience. The hell with you. He wanted to go back to his cell, the only place he really felt safe. He rose. The men looked surprised. Mars said, "Let me know when you get this all figured out, okay? You know where to find me." "We actually had some more questions for you, Mr. Mars," said the first man. "You can send them through my attorney," he said. "I'm done talking. Figure the ball's in your court. You know everything about me and the case against me. What you need to do now is do the same on this Montgomery dude. If he did kill my parents, then I want out of here. Sooner the better. The guards took him back to his cell. Later that morning, he was transported via prison van back to death row at the Polunsky unit. As he was being escorted to his old cell, one of the guards whispered to him, "You think you're getting out of here, boy?" "I don't think so. Don't care what them suits say. You a killer, Jumbo, and you gonna die for your crimes." Mars kept walking. He didn't even turn his head to look at the man, a reedy-looking punk with a huge Adam's apple. He was always the one to give Mars a hard jab in the back with his baton for no reason at all, or spit in his face when no one was looking. Yet if Mars took a swing at him, he'd be rotting in here forever, regardless of what happened with this Montgomery guy in Alabama. The cell door clanged shut, and Mars, his legs oddly wobbly, lurched over and fell rather than sat on his bunk. He immediately hauled himself up and, from long habit, put his back against the concrete wall and faced the door. No one could attack him through concrete, but the door was another matter. His mind went over all that had just happened in the last 10 hours. His execution was to take place. He was prepared for that, or as much as anyone could be. And then it had been called off. But if they weren't convinced by this guy in Alabama, could they still execute him? The answer to that, he knew, was probably hell yes. Don't mess with Texas. He closed his eyes. He wasn't sure exactly what emotions he was supposed to have. Happy, nervous, relieved, anxious. Well, he was feeling all of them. Mostly, he was feeling that somehow, some way, he was never leaving this place, regardless of what the investigation showed. He wasn't being fatalistic, simply realistic. He started to sing a tune under his breath so the guards wouldn't be able to hear. Perhaps it was stupid under the circumstances, but it felt right anyway. "Oh, when the saints, oh, when the saints, oh, when the saints go marching in. Oh, Lord, I want to be in that number when the saints go marching in." Chapter 3. On the very last day of the year, Amos Decker sat in his rental car in the drive-through line at a Burger King near the Ohio-Pennsylvania border, pondering what to order. Most of what he owned was in the back seat and trunk of the car. He still had some things back at a storage unit in Burlington. He could not part with them, but he didn't have the room to bring them with him either. He was a big man, 6'5", and about halfway between 300 and 400 pounds. The exact number depended on how much he ate at a particular meal. He was a former college football player with a truncated stint in the NFL, where a vicious blindside hit had altered his mind and given him pretty much a perfect memory. Hyperthymesia, as it was technically known. It sounded cool. It wasn't. But it had been nothing compared to walking into his house one night to find his wife, brother-in-law, and daughter brutally murdered. That killer was no longer among the living. Decker had seen to that. But the conclusion of that case had also led him to move from Burlington, Ohio, to Virginia to take up a unique position with the FBI. He still didn't know how he felt about it. Thus, he ordered 2 Whoppers, 2 large fries, and a Coke so big he had difficulty holding it, even in his huge hand. When he was anxious, he ate. When he was really anxious, he was at garbage disposal. He sat in the parking lot and devoured his meal, the salt on the fries sticking to his fingers and sprinkling across his lap. Outside, the snow was falling lightly. He had started his journey late and was tired, so he wouldn't finish the drive tonight. He would grab a bed at a motel in the Keystone State and then complete his journey the next day. Special Agent Ross Bogart, the man he would be working for at the FBI, had told him that all of his traveling expenses, within reason, would be covered. He'd actually offered to fly Decker to Virginia, but Decker had declined. He wanted to drive. He wanted some time to himself. He would be working at the FBI with a woman he'd met in Burlington, a journalist named Alexandra Jameson. She'd shown her smarts during the investigation of his family's murder, and Bogart also wanted her as part of his unusual team. Bogart had laid out to Decker the details of his vision of this team when they'd both been back in Burlington. It would operate out of the FBI's Quantico platform. It would bring together FBI agents and civilians with special skills to reopen and, one hoped, solve cold cases. Maybe we'll be a team of misfits, Decker thought. He didn't know how he actually felt about moving to the East Coast and essentially starting over. But he'd figured he had nothing left in Burlington, so why not? At least that was how he had felt last week. Now he wasn't as confident. Christmas had come and gone. Today was New Year's Eve. People would be out partying and celebrating the coming New Year. Decker would not be among them. He had nothing to celebrate, despite the new job and new life. He had lost his family. Nothing could replace them. Thus, he would never have anything to celebrate. He threw the bag of trash into a receptacle in the parking lot, climbed back into his car, and drove off. He turned on the radio. The top of the hour was coming up as he found the local NPR station. The news was coming on. The lead story had to do with a death row inmate whose life had been spared, melodramatically, at the last minute. It had been a last-second Christmas present, the announcer said. The man's name was Melvin Mars, and he had been convicted over 20 years ago of killing his parents. Now, all of his appeals had been denied, and the state of Texas was ready to take the man's life as punishment for his crimes. But startling new evidence had emerged, the announcer said. A prisoner in Alabama had confessed to the crime and had allegedly offered up details that only the real killer could have known. Mars, a former college All-American, Heisman Trophy finalist, and top NFL prospect, was currently still behind bars as he awaited the results of the ensuing investigation. But if that investigation verified the confession, reported the announcer, then Melvin Mars could go free after 2 decades behind bars. His NFL dream was over, of course, but perhaps justice would finally be served, if a bit late. Damn, thought Decker as he turned off the radio. Some justice for Melvin Mars. Then his mind started worrying, his memories flashing past in neat chronological order. Though Decker did not really need his hyperthymesia to remember this one. Melvin Mars was a star running back at the University of Texas. The Longhorns had played Decker's team, the Buckeyes of Ohio State, on the last week of the regular season in a nationally televised game. Decker had played linebacker on his squad. He was tall for a linebacker and was a good player, but not great. He had the size, strength, and toughness, but didn't have the wheels and pure athleticism of the truly outstanding players. Mars had made life miserable that afternoon for Decker and the Buckeyes. Texas had ended up winning by a whopping 5 touchdowns and ruining any chance Ohio State had for a national championship. Mars himself had scored 4 times, 3 by running and once with a nifty catch and run starting at the Buckeyes' 35-yard line. Decker remembered that one well. He had been covering Mars on the play as he came out of the backfield. He had hit Mars with everything he had as soon as he caught the ball, but Mars had somehow managed to keep on his feet, juke the corner and then the safety, and then run over another safety coming in near the goal line as Decker lay on the field 30 yards back. It had seemed like the 5th time Mars had gotten the better of him that day. As his coaches later pointed out on film day, it was actually the 10th. Decker had gone to the bench after that hit and miss. The Longhorns were up by 28 points with less than 6 minutes remaining. They would tack on 1 more score when they got the ball back after an interception. It was Mars again who hit the Buckeyes' starting middle linebacker, a wall of granite named Eddie Keyes, who would go on to play 12 years with the 49ers, so hard that the man had been blown backward into the end zone as Mars made his last score of the day. Melvin Mars. Decker had thought the guy would be a shoe-in for the NFL, too. It was a big story back then about Mars being arrested, but Decker had been working hard for his own shot at the big leagues, and the arrest and conviction of Melvin Mars finally had faded into the past. 2 decades in prison for a crime he maybe didn't commit. Another man had confessed, had details only the real killer would know. It was so close to the murders of Decker's family that not even his unique mind could grapple with the possible odds of it. He drove right through Pennsylvania, and then south into Maryland, and farther south into Virginia. He didn't stop to sleep. His mind was alert and awake and thinking. He was thinking about Melvin Mars, a name from the past. Decker did not believe in fate, or even its little cousin, Serendipity. Yet something had made him turn on the radio right at that very moment. If he had taken a couple minutes longer to eat his meal or stopped to take a leak, he might never have heard the story. But he had heard the story. So what did that mean? He wasn't sure. And he also wasn't sure that the name Melvin Mars would ever leave him again. Hours later, he reached the address he'd been given. It was at the Marine Corps Base Quantico, one of the largest U.S. Marine bases in the world, and also home to a basket full of federal law enforcement platforms. The facility was behind high fences with a guard gate where serious men in uniform stood holding automatic weapons. Amos Decker drove up to the gate, rolled down his window, drew a long breath, and prepared to start his brand new life. Chapter 4. Three rooms. A bedroom about the size of a prison cell. A bathroom about a quarter the size of that. And a third room for everything else, including the kitchen. It was far more space than Amos Decker had been accustomed to over the last year and a half. He set his bags down and looked around his new home. He should grab some sleep, but he wasn't tired. He could sleep all day sometimes, but other times, like now, his mind would not allow him to rest. His brain was on fire. There was a small table across from the kitchen area. On the table was a laptop computer with a note stuck to it. The note was from Agent Bogart. The laptop was his to use. There was secure Wi-Fi here. Bogart would be by later. Decker checked his watch. It was 5 a.m. Bogart had expected him to stop on his drive and probably anticipated his arriving here later this afternoon or evening. Decker made a cup of coffee, black, with a heap of sugar, and carried it over to the table. He sat down and opened up the laptop. He went online and searched for the name Melvin Mars. There had been quite a few stories written in the last few days on Mars. Decker read all of them, his perfect memory imprinting each indelibly onto his brain. But he also wanted to know more about the man's past, and a few minutes later, he found it. Melvin Mars had been on the cusp of the NFL draft held in April of each year. It was projected he would go top 5 until he'd been arrested and charged in the murders of his parents, Roy and Lucinda Mars. Decker looked at the grainy pictures of the pair on the screen. Roy was white, with strong features, and even in the blurry photo, his penetrating eyes were readily apparent. Lucinda was black and remarkably beautiful, with bountiful hair that fell to her shoulders. Her face was crinkled into an infectious smile. Clear opposites, at least on the surface. Interesting. Decker sipped his coffee and kept scrolling. The murders had taken place on April 2nd. The bodies were found in an upstairs bedroom. Both had been shotgunned, their faces obliterated, and then their bodies set on fire. The house stood by itself, well off the road. They lived in rural Texas. There had been no one around to hear them die. The bodies were found by firemen responding to a 911 call. The fire was put out, and the house became a crime scene. Folks around there knew the Marses. Well, they knew Melvin because of his talents on the gridiron. He had been a high school football legend in Texas, and had continued that fame in college as a Longhorn. So where was Melvin when his parents died? He had graduated from college the previous semester, having gone to summer school each of the last 3 years in order to graduate early. He had plans for his life, it had been reported then. And with the draft coming up, he wanted to be free from academic obligations. He was a man who thought ahead, it was said. He was not some people's image of a football player who could run over people but didn't have the means to carry on a conversation. It was said that he didn't have an agent because he was going to negotiate his own contract with an NFL team. He had done research, talked to current and former players. So again, where was Melvin? The police found him sleeping alone at a motel. He had paid by credit card. That was how they located him. His story had been relatively simple. He had been visiting a friend. He had left the friend's place with the intention of driving home. He had had car trouble, however, and stopped for the night at the only motel on that stretch of road. He had known nothing about his parents' murders until the police knocked on his door. This was before everyone had cell phones or email addresses or a Facebook page or Twitter account. You could actually be off the grid with no way for folks to contact you. An unbelievable thought now. Mars had not initially been a suspect. He had gone into seclusion, even as rewards were offered for any information about the crimes. A period of time went by as the police investigated. Decker focused on one story that detailed how Mars had become a suspect. The friend he had visited remembered Mars leaving earlier than he had told the police he had. The motel was less than an hour from his house, so why didn't he simply drive the rest of the way that night? Again, Mars said he'd had car trouble and pulled into the motel. He planned to call his father the next morning to come out and check the car. The only problem with that was, when the police asked him to try to start the car, it roared to life immediately. He had no explanation for that other than to say the engine had sputtered and then died right as he reached the motel. He said he'd actually pushed it into the parking lot. The other troublesome fact was that a car resembling his had been seen later that night in the vicinity of his parents' house. The motel clerk told police that Mars had checked in at 1:15 in the morning. The friend said Mars had left her place at 10. It was only an hour and 40-minute drive to his home from there. That left time for him to drive home, kill his parents, and then drive back and check into the motel. The motel clerk testified that Mars seemed disheveled and upset. He also testified that the clothes Mars had on appeared stained with something. The clothes he described Mars as wearing were not the ones he had on when the police showed up. It was conjectured that Mars had dumped the bloody clothes somewhere and then changed into a fresh set at the motel. The other troublesome fact was that the shotgun belonged to Mars. He used it for hunting and had indeed hunted game birds and turkeys with it. Thus, his prints were on the weapon. And the gasoline used to ignite the Mars' bodies had come from their garage. It was fortunate that the house had not burned down. The only damage was in the bedroom, where they'd been found. Lastly, blood matching Lucinda Mars's had been found in the car. It was pretty damning forensically. Decker rose to pour another cup of coffee. It was growing lighter outside. He was oblivious to this. He sat back down and kept reading. But what would be the motive for Mars to kill his parents? After he was arrested and charged with the murders, the police announced their theory. With the NFL draft coming up and Mars expected to sign a huge contract, it had come down to money. His parents wanted more of it than Mars was willing to share. There had been arguments. Mars had felt jammed. He didn't want negative publicity. He had carefully groomed his image in the hope of getting lucrative endorsement deals in addition to his football contract. He had his whole life mapped out. His parents potentially stood in the way of that, at least according to the prosecution. So, to get rid of this problem, Mars had planned and then executed their murders. He had visited the friend to establish an alibi, gone home, killed them, and then driven to the motel. However, like many killers, he had tripped over the small details. But it was really the timeline that had crashed everything for him. No matter how much you plan things out, if you were indeed in one place killing someone while you said you were in another place sleeping, the timeline can never be made foolproof. There will always be cracks, even if only small ones. But if the police focus on them and start digging, those cracks can grow large and bring the whole lie down. And that apparently was what happened to Melvin Mars. So the prosecution could show motive and they could show opportunity. And it was Mars' own gun, constituting the necessary means, that had done the deed. Thus, they had all three essential elements to prove guilt, and they set about to convincingly prove it all beyond a reasonable doubt. Witness after witness was paraded before the jury and gave their testimony. The mosaic began to form. The prosecutor, A Tennessee grad, and thus no fan of Texas football players, it seemed, did a bang-up job stitching the evidence together. The defense tried to poke holes, but didn't do enough damage. And when Mars did not take the stand, the defense rested. The jury was out barely enough time for the jurors to use the bathroom before they came back with their guilty verdict. Mars had been given a fair trial. The evidence met the burden of proof. Roy and Lucinda Mars had been killed by their only child, Melvin. The punishment of death had been imposed. Mars's NFL career was over before it even started, and so was the rest of his life. End of story. He had been scheduled to be executed when another man had come forward and confessed to the crime. Charles Montgomery. Decker studied the photo of the man on the computer screen. White guy, in his 70s. Muscled, tough and mean-looking. Army vet with a lengthy criminal record. He'd gone from petty crap to serious stuff to very serious stuff. He was in a prison in Alabama, awaiting his own execution on several other murders committed years ago. So if Montgomery was telling the truth, how had the case against Melvin Mars gone so badly sideways? Reports said he had details of the crime that the police had withheld all these years, just as a matter of standard procedure. Montgomery apparently knew some of them. But why come forward at all? Because he was already in prison? Because he felt remorse? Because he was going to die anyway? To Decker, who had lots of experience with hardened criminals, Montgomery simply didn't look like the remorseful type. He just looked like the killer that he was. Decker finished his coffee and sat back. Someone knocked on his door. He looked at his watch. 7:30. He answered the door. Special Agent Bogart looked back at him. He was carrying a large briefcase. He was well into his 40s, tall and fit, with dark hair attractively mingled with silver. He possessed the air of quiet authority that one acquired by commanding people in difficult assignments. Childless, he was also separated from his wife and in the process of divorcing. Behind him was Alex Jameson. She was tall and pretty, with brown hair, and her expressive eyes lit up when she saw Decker. She was holding a bag of food. A jubilant Jameson said,
"Surprise! Happy New Year."
A beaming Bogart said, "I got word you had arrived early. Welcome to the FBI. Amos Decker said, "I have a case I want to investigate." Chapter 5. Decker munched on his bacon, egg, and cheese biscuit. Meanwhile, Jameson and Bogart were reading the articles on the laptop about Melvin Mars. Bogart finally looked up and said, "Fascinating stuff, but that's not really in our jurisdiction, Amos." Decker finished eating, took a final swallow of coffee, rolled up the wrapper, and made a three-pointer into the trash can next to the kitchen counter. "What exactly is our jurisdiction, then?" In answer, Bogart opened up the briefcase and pulled out a large binder. He handed this to Decker. "I've already given Alex hers. These are the cases we're considering. Read up on them. We'll discuss them later at our meeting."
"We're here now. We're meeting now."
Bogart said, "There are two other members of the team." Jameson said,
"I've met one of them, Amos. You're going to like her."
Decker kept his gaze on Bogart, who said, "So you knew this, Melvin Mars?"
"I played against him in college. The only words I can remember saying to him were, 'Son of a bitch, how'd you do that?'"
"He was that good?"
"He was the best I'd ever seen."
Jameson said,
"Well, he might be getting out of prison. That's a good thing."
"If he's innocent," amended Decker.
"Well, yes, of course."
"I doubt they'll release him unless they're absolutely sure," pointed out Bogart.
Decker gestured to the laptop. "Did you know that there are hundreds of people released each year from prison because they've been found to be innocent?"
"A small percentage considering the number of people incarcerated," replied Bogart, who was looking a bit impatient.
Decker said, "It's estimated that 2.5 to 5% of all prisoners in the U.S. are innocent. That's about 20,000 people. DNA testing was first used in court cases in 1985. Since that time, 330 prisoners have been exonerated by DNA. But DNA testing is possible in only about 7% of all cases. And in 25% of the cases where it was used, the FBI was able to exclude the suspect, so the percentage of prisoners who are innocent might be higher, maybe a lot higher.
I can see that you've done some research on this, said Bogart dryly.
A long silence ensued.
Decker, said Bogart, this is not really what we do. We investigate cold cases in order to try to find a killer.
What if Mars isn't the killer?
Then this Montgomery guy is.
What if he's not either?
Why would a man confess to a... Bogart stopped and looked a bit embarrassed. Okay, since that's exactly what happened in your case, I can see your point. But still...
Can it at least be considered by the... team? Asked Decker.
Bogart mulled this for a few moments. My plan was to let the team examine a number of possible cases and then vote on which ones to undertake. I have that flexibility.
And we can lobby on behalf of certain cases?
Asked Jameson. I don't see why not, said Bogart. I like democracy as much as the next person, he added with a smile.
I think we should take this case on, said Decker stubbornly.
And we can lobby the others to do that, Amos,
said Jameson quickly.
Like Agent Bogart said.
Decker stared down at the laptop. Both Bogart and Jameson watched him. They knew that Decker was stubborn and inflexible when he had made up his mind. They also knew he couldn't help it. It was just who he was. Bogart said, Since you arrived early, I've changed the meeting time to 2 this afternoon instead of tomorrow. He looked over Decker's rumpled clothes and unkempt hair. We'll give you time to clean up, and then we'll pick you up about 1/4 till and drive you over. It's not that far. Decker looked down at his wrinkled clothes. He was about to say something, but then he nodded dumbly and stared back down at his laptop. Bogart rose, but Jameson remained seated. When he looked at her inquiringly, she said,
I'll meet you back here.
He glanced at Decker and nodded curtly. Amos, it's good to have you on board. Decker continued to stare at his laptop. Bogart turned and left. Jameson glanced at Decker.
Lots of changes,
she said.
In a short period of time.
He shrugged.
What is really fascinating you about the Mars case?
She asked.
Because you played football against him?
I don't like people just showing up out of the blue and confessing to a crime.
Like what happened in your family's case?
Decker closed the laptop and leaned back in his chair. Tell me about the other team members.
I've only met one of them, Lisa Davenport. She's a clinical psychologist from Chicago. She's in her late 30s and very nice, very professional.
How is all this going to work? Asked Decker.
Like Bogart said, we vote on the cases to take.
But someone has to put the cases we're going to vote on together, so there's a pre-selection by someone.
Well, that's true.
She pointed to his binder.
In there. Fascinating stuff. But you can add this Mars case. Bogart said so.
He didn't actually say that. He said the case was out of his jurisdiction. He said we could lobby the others to take it. But if I get voted out, we don't take it.
He looked at her. Do I have your vote?
Of course you do, Amos.
He looked away. I appreciate that. Jameson looked surprised. Decker didn't usually acknowledge things like that.
Do you want to get cleaned up?
She added diplomatically.
I know it was a long drive, and you apparently drove straight through.
I did, and yeah, I should clean up some, but I don't have many clothes.
We can go shopping if you want, before the meeting.
Maybe after.
Anytime, Amos. I'm ready to help.
You don't have to be this nice to me. Jameson knew that, unlike other people, Decker was being quite literal.
I figure we both had big changes in our lives, and we need to stick together. There might be a case down the road I want to take, and then I'd need your support, right?
Decker looked at her thoughtfully and nodded. You're more complicated than you make yourself out to be.
One can only hope,
she said, smiling weakly.
Chapter 6. How do I get 20 years of my life back? You want to tell me that? How?
Melvin Mars sat across from his attorney in the visitor's room at the prison. Mary Oliver was in her mid-30s, with auburn hair cut short and square glasses over her sparkling green eyes. Her angular, pretty face was sprinkled with freckles.
You don't, Melvin,
she said.
Nothing can do that. but they haven't confirmed Montgomery's story yet, so let's not get ahead of ourselves.
I don't know this dude. I never met this dude. I never knew he even existed until they came and told me. So they can't say I paid him to kill my parents. And if they can't show that, I'm out of here, right?
Oliver rustled some papers in front of her.
Look, it's not that simple. We have to let the process work, okay?
Mars rose and smacked the wall behind him, drawing a stare from the burly guard stationed in the center of the room. He was far enough away that he could not hear their privileged conversation, at least spoken at normal levels, but close enough to step in, if need be.
Process! I let the process work before, and you see what it got me. They took my damn life, Mary!
It's natural to feel betrayed and taken advantage of, Melvin. Everything you're feeling, it's natural.
Mars looked like he wanted to slug something, anything, as hard as he could. But then he saw the guard's hand move to the head of his baton. He also saw the guard's mouth twitch in anticipation of kicking some prisoner ass.
Just give me a reason, asshole, please.
Mars calmed and sat down. So how much longer does this process have to work? He said in a normal voice.
There isn't a set timetable for this because of its unusual nature.
Explained Oliver, looking relieved that he was being more reasonable.
But I will keep on top of it every second, Melvin. I promise. I will push them. And if I even see them starting to drag their feet, I will call them on it, I swear. I'll file motions.
He nodded. I know you will. She said,
This must be so hard for you. When I first heard of it, I was flummoxed. I still don't know the connection between your parents and this Charles Montgomery.
Well, if there is a connection, they didn't tell me. Maybe it was a stranger thing. He breaks into the house and kills them.
But there was no evidence of a break-in, and nothing was stolen. That was why the police started to look at you.
But you believe me, right? He said quickly.
Yes, of course I do.
Melvin stared at her. Running through his mind was the thought,
Sure you do. Where we lived, nobody locked their doors, and it wasn't like my parents had much someone would want to steal. You know how we lived. My father worked in a pawn shop. My mom made money on the side sewing clothes and teaching Spanish and cleaning up other people's messes.
He shook his head.
I was going to change all that when I got to the NFL. I was going to buy them a house, put money aside. They could quit their jobs. I had plans.
He slapped the palm of his hand against the table.
I had plans.
I know you did, Melvin,
she said soothingly.
I always thought this was a big mistake somebody was going to finally figure out. Then I'd be out of prison in a few months and be playing ball. Then a year went by, and then another, and another, and then five, and then a decade, and then shit.
He grew silent, started shaking his head from side to side, his face pointed downward. A tear smacked against the laminate. Mars swiped it away with his hand.
If I get out of here, what then? I got no family. I got no job. I got no nothing.
The state of Texas can compensate you.
How much?
It's capped at $25,000.
Mars looked up at her, incredulous.
25 grand? For 20 years of my life?
I know it's grossly unfair, but that's what the current law is.
Do you know how much I could have made in the NFL?
A lot more, I know.
So I walk out of here with maybe 25 grand, or maybe less, since that's a cap. And then what?
We'll help you with that. We'll help find you housing and a job.
Doing what? Pushing brooms? Maybe I can get my father's old job in that pawn shop. That part of Texas, man, pawn shops do big business because nobody has shit.
Let's just take it one step at a time,
Oliver said, trying to keep her voice level and calm.
Even if they let me go, they might not pardon me, which means I got 2 felony murder convictions on my record. Who's going to hire my ass? Tell me that. Tell me.
Mars could see that she was growing more nervous by the second.
Petite white woman, big angry black man. That's what she sees. That's all she sees. And she's on my side.
He looked away and his tone changed again.
Hell, I don't know why we're even talking about this. They're never going to let me out of here, man.